I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Chris Seeley, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Fairfield University. We're discussing her 2020 book, Creolizing the Nation, from Northwestern University Press. Seeley works on continental philosophy, social and political philosophy, and race theory. She's the author of the book Moments of Disruption, Levinas, Sartre, and the Question of Transcendence from SUNY Press, as well as many articles. So first of all, Chris Seeley, let me welcome you to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you. It is fantastic to be here, and thanks for inviting me.
Chris, I love the book. It was a great sort of combination of the literature on creolization and literature on nationalism, a really great sort of synthesis to produce something new here, a new contribution, something innovative. I come from more of the nationalism side, and I really enjoyed the contribution here. So really well done, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Yeah, let me just first ask you what the motivation was for writing the book in the first place.
Yeah, good. I always appreciate being able to think about and talk through the motivation. I think it primarily came from my own personal experience with questions of national identity or just identity in general. So I am originally not from here. I'm from Trinidad, sort of born and raised, and came to the U.S. To go to university and ended up sort of hunkering down here and sort of building an academic life and a family life. And so, you know, definitely since leaving what I still consider to be home, that question of belonging and making a home for oneself has always been sort of prescient in my mind. But definitely, you know, towards sort of my later years as sort of living as a U.S. resident here in the United States, you know, when, I had the option to become naturalized, and that's kind of what you do, right? You sort of live here for a long, long time, and then you sort of build a foundation and a life, and it's just sort of like the obvious next step to become naturalized. But it didn't feel that obvious to me. It really sort of gave me a reason to pause and think about what that move would involve, not just for me, but in general, right? What does this question of what is this notion, what is this arrangement of nationness mean, and what does it do or not do for us? I guess, like many or most academics, I sort of wanted to figure this out for myself, and started, you know, reading up what other people had to say about it, to help me come to terms with my own questions. And it eventually led into a project where, you know, I felt I could interject something sort of new and unique into the sort of four-way of grappling with questions. So yeah,
good.
That's how it started, actually.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, can I ask you to, if you would, you know, recount the story that you have in the introduction, which I found to be pretty powerful, about your, you know, the birth of your child and how, you know, because this was, for me, I think really was a nice sort of evocative, you know, piece in thinking about nationalism, contemporary implications.
My first boy, Isaiah, I have to give a shout out to my good friend, Mike Monahan, who, you know, in generously sort of reading early drafts of the intro and the book, really pressed me to say more about this experience of giving birth in this way. Because, you know, as philosophers, we're not like particularly comfortable with like sitting too close to ourselves as we theorize. So I'm like, I don't know if I want to get too close to that. But He really pushed me to do that, and I'm kind of glad that I did. it was a moment where, you know, again, I was living in the U.S., you know, towards the end of my graduate program, about to give birth, and it was a very sort of palpable encounter with, intimate encounter with the implications of border makings, right? Like, so here I was as this vessel for this child, and there was a point at which, you know, it rested in so many accidental, coincidental things that Isaiah happened to not be born in the place and moment that he was, right? So if I gave birth while I was visiting home, it would have been a different story. But in any event, so I am the vessel of this human being, and our sort of life and well-being is very much intertwined. And then he sort of emerges out of me via C-section, if that's not TMI, via C-section. And, you know, it was this strain, right, on the discursive practices that we use to delineate where obligations to community members begin and end, right? So we're in the, you know, pretty sophisticated post recovery room, and, you know, Isaiah is getting all the care that he needs, and I get all the care that I need, and everyone is lovely and making sure that we're comfortable and healthy and moving along. And then at the end of the process, it's just, you know, the bill comes, and, you know, what gets billed as, you know, as coverage for a belonging U.S. citizen, and what doesn't get billed for a belonging U.S. citizen is like super zany and kind of zigzaggy, right? So my morphine drips don't get covered, but, you know, the cut that is made to get Isaiah out into the world so that he can become a U.S. citizen is covered. And so, yeah, and so that always stuck with me, and really made this category of questions all that more pressing. Like, I felt the I felt the tension in that birth giving process.
Right. I mean, the boundaries of nationalism became unsettled for you in a really personal way, right?
I mean, it's always been unsettled, right? Because, you know, like, Trinidad is both home and not quite the way it used to be home, right? This place is not quite home, but it's more home than what it used to be. So it was always a little bit an unsettling sort of articulation of border making, but definitely in that moment, right? Involving like flesh and actual bodies sort of becoming disentangled from each other. It was just a thing that I had to write about to mm-hmm. make sense for my own self. Yeah. So
that's great. Well, I'm glad you did. Let's turn to your main thesis. I mean, the book is called Creolizing the Nation. I thought maybe if you could just we sort of unpack those two terms in the title, talk about creolizing first. Maybe you could say a little bit about what that concept is, especially for those not familiar with it like me, maybe a little bit of history on it, how it's been applied in the literature and how you're using it here.
Right. Sure. I'll start with the question, what exactly do I mean by creolizing? And I think for the most part, what I mean by creolizing, how I use the term, is not at all different from the way scholars of creolization use the theory and use the frame. So creolizing in bringing the process of the concept to the idea of the nation, I want readers to understand that it it's a political project, right? So the frame of creolization for me, as this political project, or is a political project, insofar as it's allowed me to foreground the kind of politically salient work that happens at the level of the everyday, right? So sort of these intimate spaces and moments of our lives, very much like that moment of giving birth, right? So these sort of quotidian acts, decisions and gestures, whose efficacy is about disrupting, perhaps only in that particular moment, the habitus of a colonial and perhaps also white supremacist logic, is what is being framed and theorized through the idea of creolization, right? And so on this reading, creolizing the nation, to sort of get to the second part of your question, is about asking us to be attentive to certain agencies from below, if you will, that are always coming up with new and more liberatory relationships to power, to domination, and really doing so in a way or in a time where or when it shouldn't be possible, right? And it's precisely in that vein that I understand the project as a political project. And so really my reading of creolization and my use of it for the project aligns with attempts that try to theorize the ways in which communities have always practiced freedom, and practice freedom in or against a context of unfreedom. And here I'd like to give a thank you to my good friend Devonia Havis, who really helped me think through this idea of, or this way of think of talking about freedom as a practice. So the historical context of unfreedom, past violence, living in present structures of oppression, is really key to what creolization attempts to theorize, and the precise nature of its political significance for a place like the Americas and the Caribbean in particular. So, so the graffiti artist, right, the so-called vandalizer, is engaged, as an example, with these practices of freedom. Jazz is engaged with these practices of freedom. You see this happening in life ways of enslaved Africans on the plantation, right, as they etch out a space for their humanity while or as they are reduced to chattel, and then doing all this in a way that goes unnoticed, right, that remains opaque to dominant power and dominant structures. So I don't know if you want to jump in.
That's good. I mean, just for clarification, because I find this interesting.
I can say more, but I'll stop.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I want you to say more, but let me just intervene just for clarification. I mean, so I get it. So creolization is a form of liberation, essentially for people who have less power, especially in colonial settings. One of the things I'm wondering about is, you know, like, what actually is the activity of creolizing? Like, is it, as you say, creating a space that's distinct from the dominant culture, the dominant nation? Or is it sort of like remixing the dominant culture and the dominant nation in an unexpected way? Or both, maybe?
I mean, I think it's both. And I think to stay with your language here, it's doing the latter by way of the former, right? So in the book, I actually use this topography of remixing, right? I sort of tap into hip hop culture and DJ turntabling culture, right? It's the idea of remixing old and new, negotiating in and against structures of domination, so that somehow there's a way in which one can live alongside or perhaps sort of disruptively within those structures of domination in a way that doesn't topple those structures, but in a way that perhaps sort of metaphorically says to those structures, you haven't yet considered all the ways in which you can deny my humanity, if that makes sense. So so I very much appreciate the terminology that you offer here, because that's kind of what the book does, about remixing and negotiating in a way that's actually of necessity,
right?
It
raises the question for me about the, I guess, the relationship to the revolutionary tradition, which is a language that you use in the introduction. Because, yeah, I mean, one of the things, I guess one of the ways to put the question is, you know, like, is creolization a form of revolution? And I guess, like, my way of thinking about revolution is to make a break, right? A radical break. Whereas the way you were describing it sounds like it's not, you know, it's not really unsettling the dominant culture, but it's making some elbow room. So is that, like, I guess you have, I mean, maybe there's room for both of these different concepts, but is it like a more radical way of thinking, or is it more, I don't know, I mean, conservative with a small c, in the sense of sort of remixing and rejiggering with the culture to sort of create more room for lots of different people for freedom?
Right. Yeah. So I think, what was I going to say? I think that, so to maybe like begin answering this question with, you know, and paying attention to exactly the sort of extent and totality of the structures of domination and violence that we're talking about, right? And I think someone like Frantz Fanon, who I really get into in the last chapter of the book, is really helpful here. But not only Fanon, right? So it's the idea that you know, to think about colonial forms of violence, to think about the violence of empire, and the ways in which, and it's sort of arms of dehumanization and genocide, the ways in which that violence is racialized, right? Is to really understand this violence as really total, right? All encompassing, right? And I think if we start with that premise that the violence with it that we're thinking about is totalizing and all encompassing in this way, to then turn our attention to the ways in which the communities dehumanized and violated by these structures of violence are always already making a way out of no way, right? Figuring out how to dream in blasphemies, that's not my phrase. I'm borrowing this phrase from the scholar Micheline Crichlow. I think that in and of itself needs to be understood as both radical and maybe revolutionary with a lowercase r, right? Because this is, in fact, not supposed to happen, right? How does one explain, right, to think about the violating transformation needed to turn human beings into forms of chattel, right? And to then bear witness to those quote-unquote objects of chattel, you know, insisting on their humanity nonetheless and figuring out a way to do so, right, that's complicated, is in and of itself sort of very tiny moments of radical reimaginings of what it means to be human. So, but I do hear what you're saying, right? So, like, in what sense should we articulate this in terms of rupture, right? How radically otherwise it is. I mean, I'm still, I think that's still an alive question for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's like various camps in critical Black studies that think about this notion of rupture, this notion of the radical outdoors, right, to borrow from someone like Fred Moten, thinks about that that differently. But I'm willing to make a case, or at least try to, that that in and of itself is a kind of rupture that we need to, you know, be able to theorize.
Yeah, good. So to turn over the nationalism side of things, so maybe you could sort of walk us through the criticism of nationalism, or at least it may say what I thought of as a kind of traditional concept of nationalism. That is one that, as you describe it, has as its basis a certain conception of unity, you know, or oneness, a kind of metaphysical oneness that doesn't brook any of internal diversity, but as you say, is kind of, you know, has a sort of timelessness to it. It's all encompassing in terms of its space across its territory. So maybe you say, you know, sort of say a little bit about, you know, your first couple chapters there, your first part of the sort of the critical way in which you get at nationalism, and then how your creolizing turn in nationalism helps us think about it in a different way.
In different ways, yeah. Right, and so, I mean, so this is coming primarily from the work in Chapter 1, right? So I begin by, you know, thinking about the idea of the nation or nationness, right, in terms of, or as a frame that that centers these tropes of purity, unambiguous belonging, that asks us to think about our relation to difference in terms of this metaphysics of the one. But also I'd like to offer that how this is centered and how it plays out in sort of everyday culture of nationalism, we can think of it as a spectrum, right? And so there are differences in degrees in how these tropes of purity and unambiguous belonging affect and shape our relationship to the nation and our relationship to ourselves as national subjects. I would also say this is a very interesting time to be talking about these particular things, right? But, it, you know, like, there's a variation in degree, but I think for the most part, you know, so national belonging and national identity can be sort of safely understood in these terms. That chapter, that first chapter, and again, I don't say nearly everything that could be said, right, about the history of nationalism and how the idea of the nation sort of began to definitively shape our sort of geopolitics and sense of selves, right? There's like so much more than that I could have said. But I do say in that first chapter that, well, I ask the readers to sort of, bear with the way I curtail that conversation, because I'm really trying to prepare that conversation around the nation to take up this question, right? So how does this particular encounter, both with ourselves as nationalized beings or creatures or subjects, and our sense of belonging in terms of the nation, how does that encounter change if we think about all those things in terms of this colonial history of contact, right, across this bumpy or uneven, if you will, power terrain, right? And because that's precisely what creolization asks us to do, right? To begin our mode of inquiry with the recognition that we have to begin we have to reckon with this history of contact as a consequence of sort of colonial mappings of the world and all of that happening across this uneven power terrain. And so the things that I say about nationness is really to prime for that particular question. And so the claim is that when to think about and the nation as creolizing offers us something very different, right? Not in terms of just degree, but in terms of kind, mm-hmm. when it comes to these tropes of purity and homogeneity and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess that just as a kind of follow-up on that, because, I could see, so when I come to the concept of nationalism, I immediately think of this distinction between ethnic and civic nationalism. And, you know, I can totally understand how your critique targets ethnic nationalism, right? With a conception of like blood and soil that has a, you know, real sense of unity and timelessness. And I get that. But I get, maybe you could say just a little bit about, you know, how you think about, you know, civic forms of nationalism. Maybe it's already implicit in your answer before that, you know, there are degrees in these conceptions of nationalism, but at least with civic nationalism, you get a sense that, you know, that the nation is constituted in terms of certain kinds of principles or institutions where there can be, you know, a wide variety of different sort of cultural and ethnic, you know, diversity and hybridity and whatnot. So in some sense, the civic form of nationalism is sort of, you know, would you know, nod their head yes for a lot of what you're saying. What do you think of the civic form of nationalism?
Yeah, right. I'm glad you asked this question, because it does give me an opportunity, to kind of think through what I'm about to say. So, you know, if I'm understanding the question correctly, right? So it's very generally the idea of a civic nationalism is that you know, we move away from this sort of I guess more overtly nativist articulations of belonging and nationness, and maybe replace that with more maybe humanist or enlightenment or liberal conceptions of nation making and nation belonging, and all of that I think is true, but if you pay attention to the critique that you know, folks like, for instance, you know, Cynthia Hartman, who works in, you know, the area of critical Black studies, and you know, Black feminist studies, critiques like hers will say that, you know, these norming mechanisms coming out of the Enlightenment that I think really ground and frame a sort of civic conception of nationness are also in their own way normativities of violence, right? They also generate so as to sustain very curated and exclusionary conceptions of what it means to be human, how it means to be human, and ways that, you know, that are sort of effectively locked out, at least at the level of our sort of discursive imaginary spaces, what counts as fully human, right? So it's a critique that really is a critique that says there's really nothing to salvage, insofar as, you know, what we see coming out of this, out of these categories of principles, is also going to be used to sustain all sorts of historical and concrete violence, right, against racialized people, against communities who are gendered in a particular way. And so, you know, in the end, if I had to choose, right, definitely go with the civic over the ethnic, but I think there's still an important critical analysis to be made that identifies so as to think otherwise about the ways in which even those civic forms of nationalism engage in their own sort of version of exclusionary practices.
Yeah, that's good. I want to get into the sort of the main meat of the book, in part to sort of bring out your the conception that you develop. Because in part, you know, I mean, I guess my question, just to sort of lay it out at the beginning, and then we can kind of walk through some of these theories. But you want to reject the sort of metaphysical oneness view of nationalism, which I'm totally on board with. I too am like a civic nationalist, right? You know, pro civic nationalist over ethnic nationalist. But you know, ethnic nationalism wants to sort of combine the one and the many in a certain way, right? Whereas that's my question for the creolizing form of nationalism. Like, I get that, you know, as you develop it, it stands for the many. It stands for a form of diversification and open-endedness and hybridity. But is there room for oneness or any kind of unity at all, right? Any sort of coherence? And so that, I mean, you can feel free to develop that now, or we can sort of, I was going to turn to the chapter on Glissant's, if you want to sort of start us in there, because I think he seems that as you develop him, he has this at least in his in trying to develop his theory.
Yeah, actually, I was scrolling through my notes here to my notes on that chapter 3 by Glissant, because I think that's kind of where one would go in the book to grapple with this question that you're asking, right? So Glissant is giving us, right, he's framing it in terms of a totality in relation, right? So he's very much making it possible to think in terms of totality, a totality that is perhaps not totalizing in the sort of standard traditional sense, and so there are mechanisms in his theory in particular, and I think in creolization in general, there are conceptual mechanisms that allow us to think in terms of this unity, right? So Glissant will use language like, you know, a gathering into relation, totality in relation, the idea of tout monde, right? So there's this hearkening to unity, but I think it comes down to a difference in how and where we locate the sort of stress level, if you will, right? And so I think how he wants to ground this way of, this different way of, this creolizing way of thinking totality in a particular geography, right? So he's looking at the Caribbean archipelago, the Caribbean islands, that sort of geographic arrangement, as a sort of spatialized metaphor to help him think about totality in a different way, right? To help him think about totality in a way that doesn't get us to reductionism, that doesn't get us to this sort of assimilative move that says, you know, like, you only get to be human if such and such and such, right? So to go back to the geographic formation of the Caribbean, right? So he's saying, well, so this conglomerate of islands needs to be thought of as sort of a gathering of multiple and multiply unique islands, right? But they're all connected, not by landmass, right? But they're connected via and through bodies of water, right? And as I was kind of thinking about this in preparation for our chat today, I just recently began reading Tiffany King's The Black Shoals, which is an amazing book and everyone should read it. But in this book, right, so she, in her introduction, I believe, she references indigenous scholars working from or in the particular geography of the Pacific Islands. And so she, you know, in that referencing, she's showing us or describing the ways in which these scholars are trying to complicate or to offer a more complex understanding of shoreline or land edges and borders in relationship to water. And so she, I'm going to paraphrase here, but she asked something to the effect of, what if it's possible to think about the water as what connects as opposed to what separates, right? And so it's in that sense, I think, Glissant would also want us, was also asking us to think about this differently articulated conception of totality, a totality that connects in a way that water connects various island masses, right? That both allows for singularity, not at the expense of a different kind of unity. So, and I went sort of meandering to get
no,
to
that's
that.
Great.
I hope that made sense.
It's great. I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, what makes water distinct from land that divides us, you know, and I mean, because that's a really interesting idea. Like, you know, when you have land that divides, you just sort of put an arbitrary border between, you know, I'm in Texas, you know, it's like arbitrary border between us and Oklahoma, say, right? It's just like a straight line on the map.
Right.
Whereas when you have borders that involve water, it's sort of, it both connects and divides at the same time, right? It's not just an artificial sort of humanly created structure. So it does open up this sort of, that kind of natural, you know, unity and difference sort of at the same time. I find that interesting as a way to think about, you know, the sort of natural belonging and natural separateness.
The question that I think Glissant offers for us to think about is, well, you know, why not deploy a conception of sort of, you know, socially articulated borders as similarly fluid or as similarly dynamic or as curdled, right? To use what I get from Maria Lugones in the sort of middle chapters of the book, right? And so, to pose that question really sort of puts the burden back on us as the readers to say, well, why don't we? And what are the various agenda, right? The various agendas that is being supported in making that decision not to encounter and think about borders in this particular kind of way.
Yeah. Just as a question about Glissant, because as you're talking about him, is he a Heideggerian? I mean, is that his intellectual background? You know, is this discussion about the gathering and the world?
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, interesting. So, I mean, I think Glissant, as far as, like, you know, who's his closest, you know, white European male cousin of sorts.
right.
You know, most folks will go to Deleuze.
Okay.
I've never really encountered any engagement with Glissant through Heidegger, which is not to say that they don't exist. But yeah, he's most often brought into conversation with the work of Deleuze.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Sort of, like a dynamism and what am I looking for? The sort of the virtualness of movement and fluidity, that sort of thing. So
good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll come back to him in a minute when talking about Frantz Fanon, you know, the way you bring him in contact with Frantz Fanon. But I was wondering maybe you could say a little bit more about when you mentioned a minute ago that you have a chapter on the Latina feminists' contribution to this discussion. And I thought maybe say a little bit about how you bring them in and you know, what sort of significance do you draw out of their thought for your project?
Yeah. So originally in planning the book, so chapter 4 and 5 is really where most of this engagement with scholars Latina Feminist Scholars happened, and originally that was supposed to be sort of its own section. And then, you know, it's the way it's arranged right now is that I use Latina feminism, or I get from Latina feminists both uniquely productive theoretical conceptions that, you know, I claim can be used alongside Glissant's conceptions, but perhaps even more importantly, I get from Latina feminist scholars a way to bring these conceptions, or a way to use these conceptions for sort of on the ground political work, right? In ways that you know, it's perhaps a little bit more difficult to get just by using Glissant by himself, right? And so, you know, chapter four, you know, so this is chapter four and five. Chapter four, I turn to the work of, you know, very heavily Maria Lugones and Mariana Ortega, because they're both giving us conceptual tools to think about subject formation, right? The idea of like what it means to think of myself as a self, to think about subject formation that's very much informed by not only their own experience, but the experience of the communities with which or about which they're theorizing, right? The idea of a subject as not sort of homogeneous and unchanging, but as in truth and fact, quite heterogeneous, quite unstable, and sort of bringing together histories and linguistic forms, cultural orientations that are sort of surprising to imagine being put together, right? And so Lugones is, you know, she offers her critique of fragmentation, right, which is to say, well, it's to think about this way of subject formation in terms of fragmentation, right, in terms of like pieces trying to be put together, is to simply support a politics of purity that facilitates oppression for these sorts of communities in question, right? So there's a critique of fragmentation. She wants to replace it with a sort of non-fragmented conception of a heterogeneous self, right? So a self that is both heterogeneously, I don't know why I can't say that word today, constituted and non-fragmented at the same time. And then alongside that, Mariana Ortega's, she's given, you know, her interesting distinction between what it means to be uneasy or perhaps somewhat alienated in the world in both a thick and thin sense. And to say that, you know, that there's something productive and generative about acknowledging that this heterogeneous subject who is sort of thinly uneasy in the world, being able to do all sorts of critical political work. Right, so sort of right, bringing the theory down into the praxis of the everyday. So that's kind of chapter four, and then chapter five, I sort of flesh out that sort of political those political implications of the concepts. So
yeah, that's great. I mean, I don't know if you were thinking about this in the context we were talking just over a week after the election. Which was a crazy election, and one of the notable things, I was reading your book as I was, you know, reading about, you know, the so-called Latino vote, which, you know,
yeah,
in Texas and Florida, you know, so the media was saying was swinging to the right, you know, and
mm-hmm.
One of the things about this, when, you know, the media talks about the Latino vote, or, you know, it's as if this is like a monolith, right? And you know, so I didn't know if there was anything that, you know, these theorists have to say about, you know, just sort of the category of Latino, Latina, or Latinx itself. as, I mean, is this something of a problem? I mean, you think about, you know, the Florida returns. It was, you know, largely sort of Cuban Americans in Miami-Dade County. It was, you know, to like refer to the Latino vote itself is already a little bit distorted. I mean, so that's on the one hand, but then on the other hand, I think at the same time, I mean, this is an opportunity for a development of a kind of identity politics, right? If you can gather together a bunch of different groups under one banner and advance, you know, the cause of freedom for all those groups, then maybe that is something to draw on and remix for your own purposes. So I could see it sort of going either way. So I didn't know if that there's any, you know, if you were thinking about that in the context of these thinkers, or if this sort of adds to the discussion there.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't venture to, you know, to say something like, well, this is what Lugones would have said, you know, about this particular moment in U.S. presidential elections, or what Mariano Ortega would say. But I would say that, you know, the point that you're raising is, I think, very much at the foundation of both the theoretical and political work that these scholars are doing, which is that it's already you already miss the boat when in having these sorts of conversations and thinking about these sorts of questions, you forget how history grounds, right? So what is the Cuban American relationship to both colonial history and the legacy of that colonial history in the sort of present neocolonial era, right? To my mind, that's very different from, let's just say, the Puerto Rican American history of colony, colonial conquest, right? And so to forget how history inflects differently, you know, through and across these supposedly homogenous constituencies is to do all sorts of zany misreadings, right? And but because history, right, historical grounding does matter, and so that point is very much a central part of this sort of brain space of this book.
Yeah, good. So I wanted to ask you, say a little bit about the chapter in which you discuss the bring Franz Fanon into conversation. So I mean, your book is, I mean, I like it. It's sort of in the very content of it, you sort of you affect the kind of remixing, you know, the you know, by bringing together these different figures and bringing them into dialogue. It's great. So you bring Franz Fanon and Glissant into this discussion, right? But maybe you can say a little bit about how Fanon adds to the discussion. I mean, in some ways, he, you know, he's also sort of revolutionary, post-colonial type figure. But maybe, I mean, I really don't know much about these figures, but strikes me as, I don't know, more radical in certain ways, trying to make a more radical break. So how do you fit them together? Do you see tensions between them? How do you fit them together in your project?
Yeah. So first of all, at any given point in time, I think regardless of what project I happen to be grappling with, I always find myself reading something by Fanon, right? Either for writing purposes or teaching purposes, like some Fanon is always on my desk or somewhere near my desk, right? And so, you know, in beginning to think about this book and getting into Glissant a couple years ago, that was no different, right? It was like Fanon very close by, as always. And so, you know, the way I began to read Glissant, as I was sort of always already grappling with Fanon, I see Glissant's work, I see Glissant's work as a sort of articulation of a cultural or imaginary space that could arguably ground or be the foundation of this sort of radically different decolonial conception of the nation that Fanon is calling for, right? And so you're right. So Fanon is very much apart from Nissan's in terms of in terms of their lives, right? Interesting enough, they're both from Martinique, but you know they sort of engage in these questions from very different life choices. And so Fanon is sort of, you know, deep in the underground, right? Revolutionary struggle, anti-colonial revolutionary struggle. But as he's sort of engaged in the concrete struggle on the ground in real time, he's also thinking sort of imaginatively about like what would a new humanism look like, right? And what's required, what do we need to do to make space for that new humanism? What would a national project that is in fact completely different from these sort of colonial nationalist projects look like? And what do we need to do to make space for that sort of decolonial conception of the nation, right? And I think what I try to do, at least in chapter six, or the whole book, but especially chapter six, is to present Glissant's sort of poetic imaginary as a potential and productive response to that kind of question, right? As a way to say that, you know, the sort of cultural comportments around community formation, around, you know, the subject as errant and rhizomatic. We didn't really talk about, you know, those tropes too much, but that sort of cultural comportment seems to be what Fanon had in mind in his thinking about the idea of a decolonial conception of the nation. So that's what chapter six does. You know, I really focus on Fanon. I focus on, in large parts, on his writings that's coming out of his thinking about his time in Algeria, sort of on the ground as an anti-colonial, engaged in this anti-colonial revolutionary war against the French. And I try to use his very concrete descriptions about like the changes that are happening on the ground in Algeria, right? So around the Algerian relationship to the radio, to the veil, as sort of instantiations of the sort of creolizing comportments of you know sort of remixing these structures and artifacts of domination in a way that facilitates practices of freedom. Mm-hmm. So you know that becomes particularly interesting, I think, when we remember that Fanon. Fanon claims that in order to come up with this sort of radically new conception of the human and this radically new conception of a decolonial national project, we have to look starkly forward, right? This is a future-oriented aspiration, right? There's nothing in the past that we can salvage, if you will, that would allow us to bring this about, right? Both in reality and in imagination. So there's that, and alongside that, you know, you have Glissant, who's deploying these frames of creolization, and including in that frame of creolization is this sort of direct engagement with the past, right? The past that's fragmented and ruptured, and out of that fragmented and ruptured past, you have these practices of remixing and negotiating. So, you know, I think it's a bit of a big claim to make, to say that, you know, Fanon would be fine with using Glissant's, poetics of resistance to ground his sort of anti-colonial conception of resistance. But that's kind of the claim that I try to sustain, mm-hmm, towards the end of the book. So,
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I wanted to ask, about the sort of political implications, because this is, you know, in this chapter, you get, as you say, more into the political implications of their views. In one way, it's political through and through, of course, but with the way you develop the notion of nationalism, you say it's at the level of the everyday, right, as kind of social conception. So one of the things I'm wondering is sort of how in your view, this creolizing form of nationalism gets built up out into politics, right? I mean, again, you know, sort of like laws, institutions. I mean, that your very own personal experience itself, like how would a creolizing form of nationalism have changed your experience if that were to have been embodied in an institution or in law, right? So
yeah.
So how does this look when you start to move beyond the, as you say, the level of the everyday to sort of, and maybe there are multiple options, but
mm-hmm.
that's one of the questions I had, you know, raised for me in this chapter.
Yeah, and I think sort of implicated in your question here is, you know, where and how does the normative, the normativity come into play, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to be pretty intentional about keeping this at the level of the everyday, right? Because what I want to say is that, you know, this process of creolizing the nation or thinking about the nation as sort of always already creolizing via these sort of underground practices of freedom that jostle without necessarily toppling is not quite a sort of full frontal engagement with politics. I don't think that there's anything. It wouldn't be surprising if that sort of those sort of everyday practices sort of eventually leads to a more full frontal engagement with politics. But what I want to say is that at the level of the everyday, there's always this sort of constitutive outside, if you will. And I think that's my sort of former Levinasian self might be showing here. There's always it's a way to mark this sort of outside within, right? To say that, you know, via these sort of creolizing veins or these creolizing life ways, you have these moments of where it becomes possible to experiment or perhaps negotiate with new modes of ethics and new ways of norming that don't necessarily themselves become sort of full frontal political normativities in and of themselves, right? And I think, and so this is why I think I do this in the introduction of the book. This is why I titled the project of creolizing the nation and not nationalizing the Creole. And because there are all sorts of dangers that arise in attempts to actually nationalize these sort of Creole comportments. I trace those dangers in certain sections. I think it's chapter 2. But in order for creolization to be what I describe it as and what scholars of creolization describe it as, it has to sort of remain at, you have to read it as on the ground, a sort of tangentially engaging with a sort of full frontal politics or engaging with the level of normative politics in a way that it itself doesn't become like fully political gestures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they have political ramifications nonetheless.
Yeah. I mean, so, I could see it being taken in multiple different political ways. So, I mean, there's a way in which, I mean, it's, you know, you don't want to like reason from ethics to politics in the way Rawls does or something. I mean, that constrains the political possibilities.
Exactly. Right. And there's a bunch of different scholars, you know, working in this vein without necessarily deploying the frame of criminalization. So, you know, Cynthia Hartman's most recent book, Wayward Lives, I think when you read that and you read her accounts of how, you know, Black women in the early, I think, 19th or maybe 20th century in various cities across the nation, Philadelphia, New York, are, you know, trying to make space for themselves to be fully human in ways that are sort of affecting the overall architecture of the city, right? Their presence is felt and their disruption is felt, and their demand for that space to be fully human is felt in ways that could potentially change the trajectory of full frontal politics. But I sort of want to remain in that moment of the everyday.
Yeah, so I wanted to close with this kind of general question for you. Sometimes I close with big questions, which is not maybe
which
the best.
Not
the,
fair because
I know, right?
It's a cliffhanger. We'll leave it with a cliffhanger.
Right. So, right, exactly. Read the book is the key point. But so I guess one of the general questions I had at the end of this is, it seems to me that there are lots of people who would love and embrace your project, right? Who would love and embrace sort of open-endedness and a more dynamism of culture. But, you know, especially those who probably score high on the openness to new experiences, on personality scores and whatnot, But it seems to me there are also others who are a little bit, find a lot of anxiety, I think, in sort of dynamism and rapid change and contestation of the old. There's in some ways, you know, some human beings have a sort of a desire for, and maybe it's a connection to a fear of death that, you know, that we want, you know, there's some desire for permanence and want to hold on to that. But there's also, you know, it strikes me in a lot of sort of political movements in the modern age, and you can even just point to Trump voters, for example, a lot of Trump voters, you know, have a kind of anxiety that the world is changing around them too rapidly, and that, you know, more sort of coherence is important for that group, not
mm-hmm.
not more dynamism and contestation and open-endedness.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the question for your project, sort of the Creolizing project, is, you know, what do you do with that sort of person and that sort of need? That is a need for a kind of stability in the modern age, where the modern age is just all that's solid melts into air, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about that, you know, that kind of need and that kind of person within the scope of your project?
Yeah. What I try to foreground in the chapter where I sort of give a trace of creolization, I think this is chapter 2, what I acknowledge as what I appreciate, right, in these so-called creolizing communities that sort of grow out of this history of violence and rupture, is that there is this sort of high tolerance for sort of anti-teleology and remixing, but it's not at the expense of stability, right? So creolizing practices are sort of quite legitimately homing practices, right? This is a different articulation of being at home. A different articulation of grounding, right? A grounding that is rhizomatic as opposed to deep and rooted, right? I mean, to your question of like, how does one transform or reconfigure oneself into this kind of subjectivity. I guess as a first move, it has to start with attempts at being in community with others, right? I think that's a sort of a necessary condition, definitely not a sufficient condition, but I think part of what it takes to being open to that kind of errantry and playfulness, to kind of go back to what I get from folks like Lisant and Ligonis, is to find oneself, to find yourself in a position where that comportment of the world is required of you and necessary. And I think that's absolutely the case for these creolizing communities, right? It's out of an urgency that you have to engage with the world in this kind of way. This is the history that you inherit. And so I think transformation is possible, but it's all about being in community with different kinds of other people or different kinds of people, where that is called of you. I don't know.
Yeah.
I have friends who will accuse me of being way too optimistic, but
I get the same accusation made against me. So that's
deep.
We could be optimists together.
You know, it's like I'm a mom. Like how can I
right.
How can one not have optimism?
Yes. Despair and being a parent, I think, don't go together, that's for sure.
No, these are diametrically opposed. So.
Yeah. Well, Chris Seely, this has been such a great conversation, and so thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure, and I really enjoyed our conversation. Take care.
You too.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us, and thanks to you for listening.